9. Chaotic democracy, oil nationalization, and denied hopes, 1941 to 1953. The Allied occupation of Iran in September 1941 was a rude shock to most Iranians. Facing the soldiers of the Red Army, the British Indian Army, and soon after American military personnel, seemed almost a surreal reversal of 2 decades of Pahlavi assurances of Iran's reclaimed sovereignty and the might of Iran's imperial armed forces. The shock was transient, but the consequences were not. The occupation triggered one of the most eventful episodes in Iran's modern history and revealed persistent themes in the country's recent past: the struggle for democracy, foreign intervention, and grave tensions within the polity and between the center and the periphery. Disruption of the economy, political instability, tribal rebellions, secessionist movements, frequent imposition of martial law, and growing hatred toward foreign powers were the darker outcomes. On the other hand, a national movement for nationalizing Iran's oil industry, the opening up of the political space, greater freedom of the press, parliamentary politics, and a nascent labor movement were promising developments. Despite many political failures, the following 12 years witnessed the resumption of a process that was first started with the Constitutional Revolution, but interrupted by the rise of Reza Shah. The opening of the public space came with new ideologies, ranging from Marxist-Leninist to ultra-nationalistic and Islamic extremist. A dose of demagogy, covert and overt foreign influences, proxy politics, and the re-emergence after a brief interlude of the royal court and the army in the political arena, all led to an atmosphere of distrust and conspiracy. The new era of political openness also allowed members of the old elite and non-elite to return from the political wilderness, often clothed in a new garb. Chief among them were the Qajar aristocrat and seasoned statesman Ahmad Gavam, the journalist and partner in the 1921 coup Sayed Ziauddin Tabatoi, and Mahamad Mossadegh, the Swiss-educated lawyer from an old family of high divan officials. The younger generation of the middle-class intellectuals, professionals, and journalists were partners in the new polity motivated by Marxism or by secular nationalist vigor. The bazaar community and the urban lower middle classes, however, more often tilted toward Islamic activism. Ironically, the new era of political pluralism was facilitated under the aegis of the same occupying powers that had helped shut down Iran's democratic process 3 decades earlier. Changes in the political and economic spheres, too, were conditioned by the geopolitical ambitions and vested interests of those powers. The Soviet Union wished to expand its sphere of influence through friendly enclaves in Iran's northern provinces and by sponsoring pro-Soviet brand of communism. The British government held not only sway over a sector of the Iranian polity, but also unyielding claims over the oil fields in the south, claims that came with some measures of intervention and intrigue. And the Cold War strategic concerns of the United States transformed its relations with Iran, as elsewhere in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and Latin America, from an anti-imperialist and a bystander of goodwill to a member of the hegemonic club. In response to the domestic turmoil and foreign ambitions in the 1940s and early 1950s, a potent nationalist response seemed unavoidable. The rise and the fall of Mohammad Mossadegh characterized the successes and failures of the period, revealed first through legislation and parliamentary manoeuvres, then through nationalisation of the Iranian oil industry, and finally during Mossadegh's turbulent term as Prime Minister. Ending with the coup of August 1953, his story is an unhealed wound in the Iranian persecution narrative and a well-known chapter in the history of covert Anglo-American interventions. Iran's return to arbitrary Pahlavi rule after 1953 put a premature end to Iran's perilous experiment with participatory politics. Old Melodies Revisited. A striking feature of the Allied occupation was the breakdown of the Iranian economy, triggered by soaring inflation, scarce provisions, hoarding, and even starvation. These were indirect outcomes of a series of measures dictated by the Allies, and despite their assurances to the contrary, that Allied forces would refrain from meddling in Iran's internal affairs. Their war aims and needs of their troops proved otherwise. The occupying armies camped out in the north and south, as well as on the outskirts of the capital, needed food and provisions far beyond the surplus output of the Iranian economy, which already had been disrupted by insecurity in the countryside and limited road communications. The Allies' decision to float Iran's currency from the unrealistically low official rate of exchange under Reza Shah substantially increased the Allies' purchasing power to acquire provisions at a lower cost. The new measures triggered, almost instantaneously, a rise in prices and high inflation that lasted to the end of the war and beyond. Iranian consumers, most of whom had meager incomes and fixed salaries, viewed with resentment the foreign troops' buying power. Poverty was at the root of the riots and earliest civil unrest that broke out in larger cities and was an incentive to join the pro-Soviet Tudeh party, with its promises of greater social justice. The convulsive price increases shook public confidence in other ways. The export trade, mostly to Germany and Britain via the Persian Gulf, suffered a sharp decline as a result of the hostilities. Likewise, the import of manufactured goods, such as small machinery, consumer goods, and pharmaceuticals, noticeably declined. Lacking spare parts and other imported material, in turn affected nascent industries such as textiles, sugar refineries, and cement factories that had been established under Reza Shah. To serve the war effort, the Allies took control of the Iranian rail and road networks. The massive logistical convoy organized by the Allies' Middle East Supply Center hauled through the Persian corridor to the Soviet Union millions of tons of mostly American war materiel provided under the Lend-Lease Act passed by the U.S. Congress in March 1941. Military hardware, provisions, fuel, and machinery were transported from the Persian Gulf ports of Khorramshahr and Bandar Abbas across the Iranian plateau to the Caucasus or through the Caspian ports to the Russian Eastern Front. The supplies, amounting to at least 70% of Soviet military needs in the crucial years of 1941 and 1942, included 648,000 vehicles assembled in a plant set up by American personnel and manned by the local Iranians in Khuzestan province to assemble military vehicles and aircrafts. After the war, Iran was praised as the bridge to victory in recognition of its strategic location and contribution to the war efforts, and memorial stamps were issued. Yet only meagre compensation was paid for the services and the hardware, and that only after many appeals by the Iranian government to the former allies. The Americans duly paid their share, the British procrastinated for years, and the Soviets ignored the appeals altogether. With military convoys, the Allied camps and their personnel, also came political influence and intervention in internal affairs. To its credit, the Iranian government, despite many short-lived cabinets, numerous reshufflings and appointments and dismissals, managed to preserve a semblance of control. The agreement reached with the Allies by the Farooqi government and ratified in 1942 after months of tough negotiations, guaranteed on paper Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity, while defining the Allied presence not as an occupation, but as temporarily logistical access. It required the Allied forces to evacuate Iran within 6 months of the end of hostilities. Yet Farooqi's famous pronouncement in response to public anxiety, "They come, they go, and they don't bother us," "Miyayand va miravand, kari ba kare manadarand," proved a gigantic understatement. Although the agreement obliged the Allies to collaborate with the government in matters of internal security and to contribute to Iran's economic recovery, it also allowed for as many troops as the Allies wished to bring in. It granted the Allies full access throughout the country to all means of communication, including railroads, roads, rivers, airports, ports, pipelines, oil installations, telephone, telegraphs, and radio. What was not mentioned in the treaty, but assumed, was Britain's free hand to hunt German agents, collaborateurs, and sympathisers, which became a factor adding to anti-British and anti-Russian feelings among the Iranian public. For some pro-German elements, even as late as 1943, there was a hope that the Wehrmacht's advances over the Soviets in the Caucasus would eventually liberate Iran from the throes of Allied occupation. The Allied propaganda in Iran targeted such Germanophile tendencies, which had persisted since World War I. A declaration jointly issued at the Tehran Conference by Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill in December 1943 thanked the Iranian government for its assistance in the war against Germany, promised to provide it with economic assistance both during and after the war, and expressed the desire for Iran to maintain independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity. Yet Iran's future was not a priority for the Allies, nor did the declaration resonate much with the Iranian public. To the detriment of the Iranian government, a number of insurrections in the tribal regions complicated the occupation. They challenged the authority of the Iranian government, first in Kurdistan, then among the Bakhtiari and the Mamasani of central and southwest Iran, and soon thereafter among the Kashgais of Fars province. Tribal rebellions were in greater part a response to years of harsh treatment under Reza Shah and to his pacification campaigns. For the tribal Khans, who were released from government detention after Reza Shah's departure, engaging in customary infighting was a way of reasserting, after many years of exile, their place within the tribal hierarchy. The new climate also encouraged chief of powerful tribes, the Kashgai and the Bakhtiari in particular, to take part in the political process, even though they were susceptible to their own raw ambitions and at times to manipulations by foreign powers and their proxies. Confrontation with armed forces, especially after 1945, disrupted tribal economies and life in rural populations in the vicinity. The central government's answer to these mounting problems was at best conciliatory, occasionally draconian, and often ineffective. The ministerial posts were given to ranking bureaucrats, landowners, and secular professionals educated in the Reza Shah era, whereas premiership often went to notable members of the old Divan families. Short-lived and lacking a viable constituency, the governments in the post-war era were caught between the conflicting demands of a revitalized Majlis, which soon turned into an arena of personal and ideological rivalries, the whims and wishes of the court, and the real or assumed influence of the occupying powers. In the 12 years between 1941 and 1953, there were 15 governments in office and many more instances of reshuffling. With economic problems looming large, the situation called for new sources of revenue beyond taxation and the meagre oil income. The agrarian tax base was small, the village population impoverished, and the state endemically lacked the means of collecting taxes. In the 1943 fiscal year, the deficit ran close to 90% of the total government revenue. By 1947, it was reduced to 45%, thanks in part to reform measures introduced by Arthur Millspaugh and his team of American financial advisers, who had been employed for a second time between 1942 and 1945, to overhaul taxation and fiscal policies. Yet a chronic shortage of funds for development was serious enough to persuade successive governments to seek foreign aid, primarily from the United States, the only member of the Allied forces capable of helping Iran. Financial assistance, however, came with strings attached, mostly in the form of military assistance and advisory missions as a counter to growing Soviet influence. An increase in Iran's oil revenue, with the goal of complete nationalization of Iran's oil industry, thus seemed a viable alternative. As early as 1946, such demands were audible, even though almost from the start they ran up against the jealously guarded British interests of the shrinking British Empire. Fragile governments, tribal insurrections, and expansion of the pro-Soviet network of sympathizers and activists in turn contributed to the growth of the armed forces as the guarantor of internal security. After the fiasco of dismantling the Iranian army in mid-1941, the armed forces were reorganized in early 1942, and after the war, with the partial assistance of U.S. advisers and the purchase of surplus U.S. military hardware. Anxious to display its might and recoup its sinking prestige, the Iranian military command, schooled in the brutish discipline of the Reza Shah era, reacted severely to public protests. In December 1942, a Tudeh-inspired crowd attacked the Majlis and looted public buildings, demanding the removal of the Prime Minister Ahmad Gavam and his government on the charge of pro-American sympathies. The Gavam government, declaring martial law, allowed the military to send troops into the streets to quell disturbances in a bloody show of force, the first of several to come. The emergence of the army as a political instrument and the arrival of the American Advisory Corps to rebuild the armed forces was hardly a coincidence. Nor were the efforts of the young Mohammad Reza Shah at the outset of his reign to woo the army as a natural ally and a reliable support base. A series of public trials revealing the heinous crimes of the high-ranking police officers and henchmen of Reza Shah's time soiled the Pahlavi image. The young Shah's fear of the old notables, many with Qajar ties, and some with real or perceived foreign connections, added to his sense of insecurity. Army officers, on the other hand, were entangled in their own power struggles, and some, like the chief of staff, Haj Ali Razmara, 1901-1951, entertained political ambitions. Others were sympathetic to the nationalist cause, and a few in the lower ranks were loyal to the Tudeh party. Yet most army officers sought more than a figurehead in the person of the young Shah. They sought a refuge and a chance to regain their lost privileges and repair their tarnished image. The Azerbaijan crisis of 1946 provided the army with the chance to act as a counterforce to the growing Soviet influence and appear as a saviour of the nation. Emergence of the Tudeh Party. As in Europe and elsewhere, Soviet membership in the Allies' Grand Coalition offered the left an indispensable chance to reorganise and soon thrive as a major force in post-war politics. As early as September 1941, Iranian communists and socialists from previous years began to organise themselves into a broad coalition under the rubric of the Tudeh Party, the Party of the Masses, which was chosen to camouflage the party's overt communist identity. Some had been released from Reza Shah's prison. Others had arrived fresh from Europe or from exile in the Soviet Union. A coalition dominated by Marxists educated mostly in Weimar Germany and a few old hands trained in the Soviet Union, the Tudeh quickly developed into a disciplined and doctrinaire political machine with growing membership among the intellectuals and urban middle classes and some industrial workers, and with almost complete loyalty to Moscow. In the following years, Tudeh affiliates, including some trade unions, the Society of Friends of Peace, and youth, women, and university organizations, also helped spread the socialist message. Modern socialist ideologies were not entirely alien, having been part of the Iranian environment since the turn of the 20th century. In a land that as early as the 6th century CE nurtured Mazdakism, perhaps the first proto-communist movement in the world, such ideals had lingered for centuries and occasionally had been rekindled, such as in the early 9th century Khorram Dinan movements, in the 15th and 16th century Noktavi movement, and even during the 1849 Babi resistance in Mozandaran. During the Constitutional Revolution, modern socialist ideologies, a spillover from the 1905 Russian Revolution, reached Tabriz through the Caucasus, mostly via Azerbaijani emigre workers in the oil fields of Baku. A few managed to gain prominence on the Iranian political stage after 1909, and Iranian socialists joined the Adalat party after 1916. Among them, Avates Mikhailian, known as Habib Sultanzadeh, 1889-1938, a theoretician of some sophistication, and later a critic of the Soviets' heavy-handed indoctrination, was the chief counterweight to Haydar Khan Amu Agla and Eshanala Khan. He met a predictable fate, falling victim to one of Stalin's purges. Among non-revolutionary socialists, Soliman Mirza Eskandari, 1863-1944, a Qajar aristocrat and veteran leader of the Democrat coalition in the second Majlis, emerged as a political leader of the moderate Ajtemaiyun party, with socialist proclivities. He had maintained an ambivalent attitude toward Reza Khan, and even briefly served as a minister under him. A cultured man, Soliman Mirza represented the last of the generation who viewed socialism primarily as an anti-colonial force in a constitutional framework. The consolidation of Pahlavi rule, however, wiped out any such chance for the Iranian left. Loyalty to the Soviet leadership over world communism reduced most socialists in the eyes of authorities to dangerous agitators, if not traitors. The Pahlavi secret police quelled any form of left-leaning labour protest and trade union activities, and from 1931 on, new legislation declared illegal any communist Eshteraki organisation. Recruiting among Iranian students abroad remained the only alternative for die-hard veterans, and interwar Germany, with an active communist movement, proved fertile ground. Many Iranians studied in Germany on government scholarships. The career of Taghi Arani, 1903-1940, a forerunner of the Tudeh party, and his gradual conversion from nationalism to Marxism is a case in point. A product of the post-constitutional environment, he started as an ardent nationalist, as his adopted surname Arani, meaning Aryan, but also someone from Iran, the ancient name for Azerbaijan, suggested. His later education as a student on government scholarship in Berlin in the tumultuous years of the Weimar Republic gradually turned him into a socialist with a penchant for dialectic materialism and the scientific theory of relativity. Upon his return to Iran in 1931, when he had earned a doctorate in chemistry and accepted a teaching post at Tehran Technical College, founded by the Germans, Arani's circle of Marxist-leaning intellectuals still operated on the idea of gradually transforming Iranian society toward greater social justice and improving the lot of the poor and deprived. His publication of Donya, a journal of social and scientific debate, also was meant to reflect a spirit of evolutionary rather than revolutionary progress through education and raising social awareness. The highbrow articles ranged from causality, scientific reality, and dialectical materialism to sophisticated criticisms of the then-fashionable Bergsonian spiritualism, which he compared to the Persian counter-rationalist legacy of Persian Sufism, obstacles, in his view, to scientific progress. His arrest, subsequent trial, and 10-year sentence as the alleged ringleader of a communist circle, which came after a student protest at Tehran University in 1938, ruined the young Arani. He joined a few other Marxists of various persuasions in the dreaded dungeons of Reza Shah. That Arani perished in February 1940 at the age of 37, after 18 months of solitary confinement, is a sober statement on the fate of the intellectual left, who potentially could have articulated a different reading of Marxism, at least partially free of the shackles of Stalinism. Whether he died of typhoid, as prison authorities claimed, or was murdered in jail, as happened to many of Reza Shah's real or perceived opponents, he was destined to become a martyr of the left. In the years that followed, prominent figures among the Group of 53, Panjahose Nafar, as the Marxist convicts in Reza Shah's jail came to be known, thanks to the author Buzurg Alavi, whose memoirs of his confinement appeared under the same title, gravitated toward Marxism-Leninism, often with unabashed loyalty to the Soviet Union. An early show of the Tudeh's true colours came during the 1943 Northern Oil affair, when the Soviet Union pressed the Iranian government to acquire an oil concession in northern Iran. The Tudeh leadership advocated granting the concession in the Caspian littoral to counter, as it argued, Britain's control of Iran's southern oil fields. By 1945, at the end of the war, while insisting on the northern concession, which Tudeh described as positive equilibrium, it also closed ranks behind Stalin's decision to continue the Red Army's occupation of Azerbaijan. The Tudeh was largely influential among schoolteachers, university students and some faculty, low-ranking civil servants, intellectuals and some labour organisers, activists in the northern centres such as Rasht and Tabriz, industrial workers in Isfahan and oilfield workers in the south. Organised and disciplined, at least among its rank and file, the strength of the Tudeh was in its frequent street demonstrations, labour protests, and engaging of the public through its numerous publications and dialectical debates. The strike in the southern oil fields in March 1946 over low wages, appalling living conditions, and the overall exploitation of workers by the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, AIOC, as the Anglo-Persian Oil Company came to be known after 1938, demonstrated Tudeh's popular base and political muscle. The image of the strength the Tudeh projected was enhanced by the fact that other political tendencies failed to present a viable programme or a solid party structure. The Tudeh's domestic programme called for better wages and working conditions, land reform and an end to agrarian exploitation, mass literacy and workers' profit-sharing. These were objectives later adopted with some modifications by the liberal nationalists and, in due course, in the 1960s, by the Shah's White Revolution. Yet, despite common grounds, the Tudeh did not hesitate to label liberal nationalists as tools of American imperialism, a conspiratorial worldview shared by most communist parties of the time, as well as by others in the Iranian political arena. The Azerbaijan crisis. The end of the war ironically added to Iran's political strife. By 1945, as post-war discord solidified in the Cold War, it complicated Iran's domestic politics almost instantaneously. This was nowhere more palpable than in the autonomy-seeking movement led by the pro-Soviet Democratic Party of Azerbaijan, an episode short in duration, but with important consequences for Iran's domestic and foreign policies. The Azerbaijan crisis was the first clear contest between the Western Bloc and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. As the time for evacuation of the Allied troops drew near, the British and American forces withdrew before the end of the six-month grace period that was stipulated in the 1942 treaty. The Soviets procrastinated, however, under the pretext of security concerns for the Baku oil fields and the possibility of sabotage from the Iranian side. The prospect of the Red Army's prolonged occupation of Azerbaijan not only alarmed the Western powers, their Iranian sympathizers, the Shah, and the army, but also increasingly the nationalist circles. The memories of Russian occupations during the Constitutional Revolution and World War I came back to haunt Iranians once it became evident that the Red Army had no intention of evacuating the liberated territories under its control. More worrisome was the steep shift in the Azerbaijan Democratic Party's rhetoric on secession, which appeared to many observers in Tehran as an ominous prelude to Iran's disintegration. That the Democratic Party of Kurdistan was seeking autonomy in cahoots with its Azerbaijani counterpart added to these worries. The leader of the Democratic Party of Azerbaijan, Syed Jafar Pishevari, 1893-1947, was a revolutionary veteran of the Jangal movement who also participated in the short-lived autonomy-seeking movement in 1920 of Mahmud Khiabani in Azerbaijan, which Khiabani labelled as Azadistan, the liberated land. Earlier, as an emigre to the Russian Caucasus, young Pishevari was among the first to join the Adalat Party of Baku and take part in the 1917 Russian Revolution. He was deeply impressed with Lenin and the Bolsheviks' message of social justice and equality for all ethnicities and religions. After spending 10 years in Reza Shah's jail on charges of communist activities, upon his release in 1941, Pishevari became one of the founding members of the Tudeh Party. Soon, however, he parted with the Tehran Marxist intellectuals and resumed his activities under direct Soviet supervision. A vocal advocate in his Tehran newspaper of the Soviet positions, he was a communist in action, but an ethnic nationalist at heart. Pishevari returned to Tabriz enraged after he was disqualified as a deputy from Azerbaijan to the 14th Majlis, on the grounds that he had tampered with the votes with the blessing of the Soviet occupiers. Arriving in Tabriz, he was joined by a clique of émigrés from the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan and by a handful of local Azerbaijani radicals. Together, they formed the central cadre of the Democratic Party. Almost simultaneously in Mahabad, the Kurdish nationalist Ghazi Mahamad, 1893-1947, the head of the Democratic Party of Kurdistan, declared autonomy and, at the behest of the Soviets, soon declared support for the Azerbaijan movement. The program of the Azerbaijan Democrats was impressive, at least on paper, and in some ways reflective of resentment toward the Tehran government. The Pahlavi's centralization policies, and particularly the mandatory study of Persian in schools at the expense of Azerbaijani Turkish, treating the latter as somewhat an alien language, was a source of justifiable outrage. Beyond the issue of language, the belief that Azerbaijan had not received its fair share of political representation or economic and infrastructural priorities added to animosities toward Iran's Persian-speaking majority. Also emphasized in the Democrats' program of action were autonomy in all provincial affairs, including creation of a militia force to maintain security and implement provincial policies, primary education in Turkish, Turkish-language press, broadcast and cultural activities, establishing a university in Tabriz, proportional representation in the Majlis, overhaul of the taxation policies, and earmarking provincial revenue for development of Azerbaijan's road building, communications, urban amenities, and infrastructural improvement. Moreover, they sought administrative reforms and purging of the hated gendarmerie of the Pahlavi government and end to abusive practices against the villagers, redistribution of the state lands, and appropriation of estates belonging to large landowners who had fled the province. In achieving these objectives, potentially an experiment in federalism, the Democrats relied on a small group of communist old-timers and émigrés, left-leaning middle-class activists, a number of middle- and lower-ranking army officers, and a small peasant militia armed by the Red Army. Capitalizing on the legacy of the Constitutional Revolution, the Tabriz resistance of 1908 to 1909, the Kiabani movement, and drawing on the neighboring Turkish Republic's 1920 National Pact, the Azerbaijani Democrats envisioned their role, at least early on, as saviors of all of Iran. Yet, during its short life, the autonomous government sharpened its secessionist rhetoric, leaned more toward the Soviet Union, quarreled with the central government, disarmed the Iranian army in their Azerbaijan barracks, the police and the gendarmerie, dismissed non-Azerbaijani officials, suppressed voices of opposition, and promised to defend itself to the last drop against Tehran's attempts to reintegrate the province. To make the Tabriz government more secure, it also drove out big landowners and distributed the state lands. It paved roads, built schools, and fought hoarding and price hikes. Moreover, it advanced for the first time universal suffrage and appointed women to the party's governing body. Adopting the Soviet model, but under the guise of the Iranian constitution, it even created regional and urban councils. Subservience to the Soviets aside, the successes of the autonomous government were impressive even in the eyes of critics. No Pahlavi provincial authority had made such gains in a short period. That the Azerbaijan regime was self-conscious of its Turkish ethnicity to the point of secession clearly contrasted with Azerbaijan's role 4 decades earlier during the constitutional period, when, devoid of ethnic sentiments, the province served as the powerhouse of a nationwide Iranian revolution. The tangible change in tone was primarily ideological. As Tehran under Pahlavi rule swung more toward a Perso-centric nationalism, so did the Democrats toward an Azerbaijani identity. That there was a Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan on the other side of the border helped all the more to manipulate a sense of Turkish solidarity. From Moscow's perspective, the autonomous movement was a long shot in unifying the two Azerbaijans. There were other immediate objectives, too. Gavam's quest for good faith. The belligerent gestures of the Democratic Party raised anxieties in Tehran. The land reforms implemented by the Democrats had forced large-scale landlords from Azerbaijan and appropriated their estates. The Shah and ranking army officers, moreover, were convinced that Azerbaijan's secession is a prelude to Iran's breakup. The Red Army's candid support for the autonomous regime, and especially barring Tehran's military reinforcements from reaching Tabriz, reaffirmed such anxieties. These also resonated with the British and the American concerns for the imminent creation of Soviet satellites in Iranian Azerbaijan and neighboring Kurdistan. Yet neither the Iranian political lineup nor the still courteous relations among the allies expedited any drastic action. Negotiating with the Democrats seemed the only plausible way. The coming to office of the seasoned statesman Ahmad Gavam as Prime Minister in 1946, at the head of a broad coalition, was intended to achieve this objective, which had brought down earlier governments. Born to a family of Divan nobility, who for 4 generations were in the service of the Qajar state, Ahmad Gavam was always proud that he had prepared in 1906 the final draft of the royal rescript known as the Constitutional Decree. As Gavam al-Sultaneh, foundation of the monarchy, the Qajar title of which he was highly proud and fiercely protective, he learned his time-honoured political skills in the Qajar court. His vast hereditary estates in Azerbaijan and Mazandaran also contributed to his financial resilience. Shrewd, lofty, and yet pragmatic, he was more successful, or luckier, than his older brother, Hassan Vosagh al-Dowleh. Always ready to take calculated risks, Gavam's career was punctuated with many ups and downs. Fearing Reza Shah in his final years, Gavam wisely spent his time in internal exile and, like many notables of similar stature, in 1941 returned to the political limelight. He nursed a subtle grudge toward the Pahlavi crown while maintaining a working relationship with a wide range of players on the political stage. His premiership between January 1946 and December 1947, the second since his rehabilitation, was a renewed chance to engage in a balancing act typical of the Qajar elite, but with some important innovations. By juggling at one time the Shah, the army, the Azerbaijan Democrats, the Tudeh party, and its Soviet patron, the British and the Anglophile clique, and later the pro-British southern tribes, the American diplomats and the US military mission, as well as the old elites and ambitious members of the middle class, he managed to gain impressive results, though only briefly. His policy of positive equilibrium resembled Nasser ad-Din Shah's treatment of his powerful neighbours, and his advocacy of negotiation in good faith, hosne niyat, with his many political adversaries, was rooted in shrewd pragmatism. Most urgent were three interrelated issues: persuading Stalin to evacuate Azerbaijan, finding a solution to Soviet demand for an oil concession, and finding a way out of the Azerbaijan autonomy crisis. Soon after his appointment, he flew to Moscow along with his left-leaning deputy, Mozaffar Firuz, 1906-1988, a political enabler from the powerful Farman Farmah family. The son of Firuz Mirza Nosrat al-Dowleh, Mozaffar at the time was Iran's ambassador to the Soviet Union. Direct negotiations with Stalin led to a surprisingly favourable accord signed in March 1946 that committed the Red Army to a swift withdrawal from all Iranian territories. A Soviet-Iranian joint oil company was also to be formed to explore granting a concession in the northern Iranian provinces, but with a crucial caveat. Any such concession was conditional on the ratification of the forthcoming 15th Majlis. This was essential, as Gavam argued, since the 14th Majlis, thanks to Mohammad Mossadegh, then the leader of the opposition in the Majlis, and his allies, banned Iranian government from negotiating any oil concession with a foreign government without the approval of the legislature. The April 1946 Gavam-Sadchikov Accord, as it came to be known, also recognized that the Azerbaijan crisis was purely an Iranian internal affair and hoped that it would be peacefully resolved within the existing constitutional framework and in a spirit of good faith. Keeping the momentum, Gavam quickly invited to Tehran representatives of the Azerbaijan Democrats and negotiated a 15-article agreement from a position of strength. It conceded to them genuine grievances and their proposed reforms, while modifying their claim of autonomy by defining the Democrats-elected assembly as a provincial council, Anjomane Ayalati, endorsed by the Iranian constitution but long neglected. To further nurture the new accord with the Soviet Union, and as a gesture of goodwill toward the Iranian left, in a government reshuffle, Gavam brought into his cabinet four ministers from the Tudeh party, an unprecedented move that earned him praise in the Soviet press as the greatest politician of the East. He complemented his balancing act by appointing centrist ministers to meet the liberal nationalist constituency, as well as appointees close to the royal court and the army. To further consolidate his government and his domestic program of reform, in May 1946, Gavam created his own Democratic Party of Iran, a wide coalition that included younger socialist and liberal politicians, mostly of middle-class backgrounds, elites and conservatives of older generations, supporters of the Shah, supporters of the army, and representatives of the powerful tribes, all bundled together under one shaky political tent. By mid-1946, it seemed that his government had overcome multiple challenges and was about to remedy the country's chronic ailments. He formed for the first time a Supreme Council for devising a planned economy, overhauling labour laws, and reforming the much-abused election laws. He established a state-owned investment bank for industrial and mining developments, and he began to distribute state-owned agricultural lands to small landowners. His program appeared to be closer to an American capitalist model than the familiar state-based notions of development. Yet Gavam evidently underestimated the forces of opposition, both domestic and foreign, and their ability to close ranks against his politics of reconciliation. A group of powerful khans from the central and southern tribes hastily colluded under the banner of Nahzat-e-Junub, Southern Movement, seeking autonomy and demanding countermeasures to stop communist infiltration in the south. They enjoyed the full support of the Anglophile party of Sayed Ziauddin Tabatabai, the tacit support of the Shah, and probably his financial backing, and blessing of the British consuls in Fars and Khuzestan. Employing their tribal riflemen, the Kashgai and the Khamseh of Fars, the Dashtestani and other tribes of southern Fars, branches of the Bakhtiari Confederacy of Isfahan and Khuzestan, and the Mamasani and Boyer Ahmad of Luristan, raised havoc with the population of the neighbouring towns and villages, raiding gendarmerie and police posts, and disarming the demoralised government troops. Their chief targets, however, were the oil workers of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company and their Tudeh-affiliated trade union, which had gone on strike over pay and better working conditions, the Arabic-speaking communities of Ahvaz and around the Abadan refinery, had joined in seeking recognition for Khuzestan as part of the greater Arab nation. They even sent a delegation to Baghdad to seek support. To many nationalists and to centrists in Tehran, this was a further sign of an impending disintegration of the country. The prospect of a civil war involving the autonomy-seeking movements in Azerbaijan and Kurdistan and the threat of the rebellion of the southern tribes were too great for Gavam. Even before the start of the 15th Majlis, he was already facing tensions within his own party and from the parliamentary opposition led by Mossadegh and from the conservative quarters. No more merciful were the press, which painted him as a corrupt and arrogant aristocrat and a leftover from the rotten Qajar elite. To lessen the pressure, Gavam had to disown the Azerbaijan regime for its secessionist ambitions, dismiss the Tudeh ministers from his cabinet after only 75 days of their being in office, appoint more pro-Shah ministers, bring back the centrist General Razmara as the army chief of staff, and reaffirm the American military advisory mission added by Colonel Herbert Norman Schwarzkopf, 1895-1958, the earlier chief of the New Jersey police and a Roosevelt appointee. Moreover, at the urging of the United States and Britain, Gavam affirmed Iran's complaint against the Soviet Union in the newly established UN Security Council, and eventually allowed for preparation for the long-overdue election of the 15th Majlis, which was made conditional to the Allies' withdrawal. To outside observers, the sudden shift in Gavam orientation seemed opportunistic and thus a sign of weakness, even though by moving away from the left and embracing the centre-right, Gavam was making the most out of a difficult situation. Though, like his Qajar predecessor, he did not fully adhere to either of the two camps, his realpolitik, no doubt, was succumbing to pressure from the Shah and from the United States, especially on the question of Azerbaijan. Under the pretext of safeguarding a fair election in Azerbaijan for the 15th Majlis, the Gavam government thus felt confident enough to dispatch troops to the bordering Zanjan region, then controlled by the Azerbaijan Democrats. After a brief pause and a bloody confrontation on December 12, 1946, the Iranian army swiftly marched to Azerbaijan, crushing local resistance along the way, and soon took control of the province. The advance of the army, after months of negotiations and reneging on both sides, was not unexpected, even by the Tabriz leadership. Peshevari and most of his staunch supporters, despite their reassurances to the contrary, quickly fled across the border to Soviet Azerbaijan, leaving behind some apparatchiks and exposing their rural militia to vengeful troops and the whims of large landlords and their henchmen. In reclaiming their lost estates, landowners proved even more oppressive than the indoctrinated Democrats. Some lower-ranking party members were captured and sentenced to long prison terms. Others were retaliated against, and yet others went into hiding. The army officers who had defected to the Democrat side were promptly tried and executed. In a short time, the whole of Azerbaijan, and soon after Kurdistan province, returned to government control, putting an inglorious end to what was soon to be labelled the Azerbaijan Rebellion and its perpetrators, alien aggressors. As it turned out, the real winner of the heroic return of Azerbaijan to the motherland was not Gavam, but the 27-year-old Mohammad Reza Shah and generals of his army, who were anxious to score a victory to reverse the bad memories of the 1941 fiasco and years of imposing unpopular martial law over the Iranian public. The United States, the chief sponsor of the rejuvenated Iranian armed forces, also scored an early success in the escalating Cold War, at least on the Middle East front. The crisis had placed the Shah and most of the Iranian senior military in the American camp. The Shah, who flew to Azerbaijan, piloting a small military aircraft, was basking in a glory that was not really his, for he hadn't played a major part in the operation's planning or execution. In later years, he made sure that repatriation of Azerbaijan was commemorated annually with military parades, radio broadcasts of jingoistic slogans and military music, and the naming of streets after the felicitous event. It was the first of many acts the Shah used to exalt his own image. The collapse of the Azerbaijan autonomy movement reaffirmed the power of the political center over the geographical periphery. Soviet ambition aside, the Azerbaijan movement was a reaction to the intense centralization of the Reza Shah era and his imposition of a cultural homogenization policy over diverse ethnicities. It in effect sealed the position of the Iranian state as a centralized power and demonstrated that ethnicity, and in the Azerbaijan case the emphasis on language as the core of ethnic identity, had little chance to win out when territorial nationalism as the dominant ideology of the state complemented geopolitical factors. Gavam, however, was not entirely out of the picture. The final act of the Azerbaijan drama had yet to play out on the floor of the 15th Majlis, and chiefly through the actions of Gavam's rival and relative, Mohammad Mossadegh. After the withdrawal of the Red Army and demise of Azerbaijan autonomy, the fate of the Northern Oil Concession was to be decided. Rigging the election with the help of the royal court and the army, Gavam hoped to control the majority in the legislature, even though a small minority headed by Mossadegh, who was highly critical of Gavam, were re-elected. In October 1947, when the bill to establish a joint Soviet-Iranian oil venture in northern Iran was proposed by Gavam's government, it was declared dead on arrival. Mossadegh and his nationalist allies, some still members of Gavam's Democratic Party, vigorously campaigned against granting any oil concession to foreign powers, a crucial move that set the stage for the nationalization of Iran's oil industry 2 years later. Soon after the vote, Gavam's government, the longest serving in the post-war years, began to crumble. Massive strikes and frequent demonstrations orchestrated by the Tudeh Party and affiliated labor unions, which had become Gavam's sworn enemies, paralyzed his government. Ministers who even a few weeks earlier were loyal to him resigned, some because he appeared to be sticking to his end of the agreement with the Soviets, and others because he appeared to be reneging it. Rabble-rousers in the Majlis, such as Hossein Maki, 1911-1999, and Muzaffar Bagai, 1912-1987, who earlier supported Gavam, resigned and joined Mossadegh's parliamentary faction. The press, too, labelled him the old fox of Iranian politics. Having no choice, he resigned in desperation in December 1947 and quickly left for medical treatment in Europe. Yet, despite this apparent defeat, Whether out of good faith or through sheer manoeuvring, he had achieved the immediate goals he had set for his government, something that no other premier during the tumultuous post-war years could claim. He had ended the secessionist crises, had brought together the left and the centre, at least briefly, had opened new avenues for middle-class mobility, and had initiated a planned economy for the country.